Emily Perkins is one of New Zealand's most successful writers. In fact, as I speak, she's writing in front of me.
It's like
she is writing constantly, 24/7 she writes. Short stories, four novels, the latest being The Forests, all much acclaimed. In addition to having a master's in creative writing, she's also a graduate of Toi Whakaare, the New Zealand Drama School, and she was co-screenwriter of the screen adaptation of Eleanor Catton's novel The Rehearsal. Her first play was performed at Auckland's Maidmont Theatre in 2015, and it will open in Wellington at Circa Theatre shortly. It's an adaptation of Ibsen's The Doll's House. Plus, she and fellow writer Chris Price have edited a collection of essays about the creative process. It's called The Fuse Box. And I believe she has another novel upcoming, all fitted in around her job as a senior lecturer at the Institute of Modern Letters at Victoria University. She's also been appointed a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit for her services to literature. Given all that, I'm not surprised that you're writing constantly. Scribble, scribble, scribble. That's what you do, isn't it? Let's look at your theatrical career, because you were in Open House in the 1980s, and you went to drama school, the stage being on stage, not for you.
No, definitely not for me in the long run or even in the medium run. I had a wonderful time at drama school. It was an extraordinary kind of education in, I suppose, in creativity and freedom and connecting with people and, you know, the self and the arts of theatre and all that sort of thing. And then we graduated and I sort of sat by the phone and sat by the phone. And you actually can't really afford to do that as a young person who wants to be an actor. I think you have to make your own work and make your own fun. And you know, in New Zealand, I see a lot of people who are very, very good at doing that. But that wasn't the path I was following. And I was at drama school with a bunch of really, really talented people, which in some ways was, I mean, it was a blessing in a lot of ways, but also because it provided me with this great contrast between their abilities and trajectories and my own. So I was in a few plays, and I was in some very good plays. I was in Ken Dunham's play, Blue Sky Boys, and I also worked doing sort of things like dressing up in silly costumes to hand out balloons and drinks for Christmas functions, the kind of thing that you might loosely categorise as performance,
right.
But yeah.
Ken Duncombe actually has got an interesting essay in the book I mentioned, The Fuse Box, Essays on Writing from Victoria University's International Institute of Modern Letters. His essay is about the psychology of the rewrite. In fact, that's what it's subtitled. And he says, it's necessary to have the courage to pull what you've done apart and start all over again. He uses the metaphor of a particular type of Scrabble game. Do you ever do that? Pull what you've done apart and start again?
Yes, and actually working on drama projects has been a really good kind of, it's given me a new way of rewriting because there's something about writing fiction on a computer which makes it very tempting when you're revising to just copy and paste everything over, start a new file and kind of move things around, you know, do your editing and all that sort of thing, but you're working, you're often working with the basic first draft and the risk of that is that you're not going to make the kind of muscular changes that you need to make.
You need to delete and start again.
And I think you need to start with a blank page for each subsequent draft. And that's a practice that I've only begun since I've been working on scripts.
Gosh.
Because that's how it tends to happen with
script
writing.
That would be such an act of bravery to delete everything.
Well, you save it. You don't burn the manuscript. You do save it because you might be able to, you know, recycle or pull things out.
No, you're not allowed to do that.
But you start a
whole
new page.
Ken Duncan says you have to be brave enough to pull what you've done apart and start all over again.
I reckon even Ken probably saves his early drafts.
Okay. So pull apart doesn't mean destroy.
It doesn't. And that's a fine, it's a very, you know, it's you learn with each different project how to judge that, like how not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm. I think Ken talks about that in his essay. You know, you don't want to just be combing through the surface and shifting decorative stuff around, but nor do you want to lose the essence of what the work is doing.
Let's look at A Doll's House. It's set In Norway in the 1870s, in the original version. Your Auckland production was set in New Zealand, newish New Zealand, contemporary New Zealand. Yeah. Have you pulled it apart and started again?
Well, I kept a very powerful part of the original play, which is the structure. It's beautifully structured. And it's
Christmas
like
Eve, Christmas Day.
Boxing Day, that's right, as we call them. And, you know, so you've got these 3 days in one place with the various players coming and going. So you've got this sort of crucible whereby the action and the tension just gets more and more and more tightly wound. And that's absolutely in the DNA of the original play. And there was no, would have been crazy to mess around with that because it's just inbuilt excitement, really.
I meant pulling your own.
Pulling my own
adaptation apart.
Oh yeah,
and
no, sure, of course. Well, I did. I wrote a first draft because it was a commission from Auckland Theatre Company, and I found
from
it really
Colin
hard.
McColl.
From Colin McColl.
Who
and
knows
Philippa
is Ibsen.
Campbell. That's right.
Because he did Hedda Gabler, didn't he?
Yeah, he's a world-renowned director of Ibsen. So it was an amazing chance to work with him and with Philippa Campbell on this, on this adaptation. But what's interesting about The Doll's House is that it's so adaptable. You could actually write an almost limitless number of reinterpretations of it because it's a very universal story at its core. So it took me a long time in the early drafting to figure out, am I going to set this in a sort of moneyed world? Is it set in the original? In the original, the husband character is a banker. He's very highly respected. Well, that's interesting. If you're putting something in Aotearoa in the 2000s, are bankers as highly respected as they were in Norway in the late 19th century? And so, you know, making all of those decisions was actually quite hard in the initial draft. And then what I came upon was the idea that I needed to set it in a world that where people were pursuing things that I believed in and admired and had integrity, and their social integrity was important to them. And then try and put them under the pressure of the events of the play and see how they respond to that. So that was the big decision about the first draft. And then, yeah, there were a lot of subsequent drafts, working with actors, working with the dramaturg and with Colin on, you know, just refining it and making sure that, yeah. And I'm still working on it. I think,
are you?
Yeah, I think that...
So have you changed? People who went to see the Auckland production, will they see a different production in Super
Theatre? Well, they'll see a very different interpretation because Cathy McRae, who's directing this production, has quite a different take on it from the Auckland production. So I think it's...
Same script, same characters.
Totally the same script. I mean, the script's been sort of refined and streamlined again a little bit more. Same characters, all of that. But, you know, theatre's such a... collaborative kind of what one person does with a production is going to be quite different from what another person does. So I feel that there are different elements that have been brought out in it.
Ibsen insisted, I mean, people will know the story. You've got Nora, who's the little woman, who reveals that she did something that will reflect badly on her husband, Torvald, but she did it for the right reasons. And in the end, because he behaved so badly about it, she goes out and slams the door.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Slam.
Yes, known as the slam of the door that resonated around Europe at the time.
Ibsen insisted that he was not arguing for women's rights, but merely describing humanity. What do you think about that?
I think that's... a really useful thing that I sort of held in mind while I was writing it, because of course the situation of the nuclear family is making them behave in a particular way. They're choosing it, but at the same time, you know, it's everywhere in the culture. They're kind of indoctrinated into these roles, and it affects everyone. It's not just that, oh, you know, poor Nora, she needs to be liberated at all. I mean, she's in many ways complicit with her own situation. But it affects the husband, it affects the outside, the secondary characters who are in the play, who I've done quite a lot of work to bring out because I feel that they're very interesting. They offer a really different perspective on how to live.
So who have we got? We've got Dr. Rank.
Yeah, so that's become Jerry, who's a moneyed baby boomer who has been through a series of marriages and lives near Nora and Theo, who's my name for the husband. And he's a great friend of Nora's, and she's a great friend of his. But there's this sort of underlying potential sexual tension and tension around money as well.
Because indeed, in A Doll's House, Dr. Rank declares his love for Nora, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
He's dying of tuberculosis.
Yes. Well, we haven't got TB in this play, but we
although
do
don't
have
they suggest that it's
illness.
Syphilitic?
They do. The Ibsen play is very interested in the idea of inherited sin, which was one of Ibsen's kind of, I don't know whether it was a preoccupation of his world at the time, but that's something that Nora really struggles with, the idea that if she, as a so-called bad person or person who's done this bad thing, sticks around with her children, she's going to infect them in
that's
some
right.
way.
That's right. What does he say? A family is poisoned by a deceitful mother. The central drama, if you like, in scene-wise in A Doll's House is Nora's performance of the tarantella. And I don't think that that's ever actually seen. Is it on stage? The practice is seen.
That's right. And then she goes and does it somewhere where you don't see that
no.
sort of off-stage party. But you see her doing it in front of the people in the room for whom, you know, who are all deeply invested in her stage.
Okay. What do you use instead of the tarantella?
Well, we've got a lovely dance. We've got some specially composed music, and we've got... we've slightly switched around. In the original play, she's pressured into doing it. And in this version, which is again a shift from the Auckland production, we've had her dancing for the others as a kind of distraction. Because what I find really interesting about, one of the things I find really interesting about Nora is that she is so used to using her feminine wiles, that's an old-fashioned term, but like using her charm, her girlishness, her body, her kind of warmth and sociability to get things that she wants. And you see throughout the play that she can do this so dexterously and seamlessly with all the different characters that she encounters. But the pressure of the events of the play, her fear that she's going to be found out for this lie, when we find out that it's more than just a lie, actually, but she's really afraid that she's going to be found out for it, just puts this pressure on her to the point where she is sort of dancing for her life, really.
And you would have found that a bit tricky to adapt to contemporary times, what the central sin of Nora.
The central sin of Nora is different. I've kept the essence of it because I think what happens is they are in a marriage where they believe that they're, as many people in marriages and nuclear families with small children believe that they're kind of special. They believe that they're living their best lives, that they're kind of, you know, and they are in many ways trying to live consciously and progressively. But I'm also interested in the way which, even within progressive movements, relationship structures are often quite conservative, or, you know, the power structures don't necessarily shift as much as you might think. And so...
Well, remember the old hippies who still treated their
exactly.
women like slaves?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that. When I was young, I read a book by, I don't know if you remember the author, Lisa Alther.
Yes.
Who wrote a book called Kinflicks and something. My mother
That's
used
right.
to read these books, and they're very funny and quite raunchy, and which is why I was interested in them as
of
a
course.
Teenage girl. But they were also often critiques of exactly that sort of hippie world where actually the men were completely unreconstructed in the sort of sense of gender politics. And although my characters don't see themselves like that at all, I'm fascinated by the rise in the interest of things like attachment parenting, the rise in young women who get married who take their husband's surname. These ways in which we... are not necessarily that different in terms of the power structures of relationships as we might like to think. You know, you might think, oh, Doll's House was first written 140 years ago. What's it got to tell us about relationships today? But actually, I think, you know, it's quite, it really does make you think about your own arrangements.
Like, we're accustomed to updates of Shakespeare.
Mm.
But the script is usually kept, the language is usually preserved in the updates of Shakespeare.
Mm, yes, when they're produced and just, yeah, recast in a different era, in the modern era. There's been a trend, I think, recently in Australian, British, American theatre for writers to take what we consider the classics and to recast them in a contemporary setting and with contemporary language.
I mean, certainly it's done with novels.
It's,
you know, Jane Smiley's 500 Acres is King Lear and all that.
Yeah,
so I suppose that's more akin to what you've done with The Doll's House.
Mm. Yeah, it very much feels like a play, I hope, of now, about now. I mean, I read the Ibsen, you know, several times and wrote my first draft, and I didn't go back to the Ibsen after that. We've just been working on revising, this version of it.
All right. But it's not necessary for people to be familiar with The Doll's House to get your play.
Oh, no, not at all. And in fact, some people have, you know, it's got a very famous ending, and some people will know that and some people won't. And
which we've just given away.
Yeah, but that's a
spoiler alert.
You know, I think that's fine because it's the question is not really what happened so much as why does this happen. It's still fascinating for us to think about why would a woman get to the point of leaving her family. It's still, you know, leaving a marriage is one thing, leaving children is another. It's very much a social taboo.
Apparently, the Germans insisted on having another ending.
They didn't like her leaving her children.
The ending was that, she sees the children and collapses, and Ibsen hated this.
Yes, yeah.
But that was very Kinder Kuche Kuche.
That's exactly right. And I think that version of the play only lasted for maybe that little period in time. It's been performed in thousands of different productions around the world. And, you know, I was in Shanghai a few years ago and talking to a university lecturer there who said that when it was, I think it was, you know, within kind of living memory first staged in China, and it was electrifying because of what it means in different kind of contexts. And I do think it's got something absolutely to say to us about how we live now in New Zealand.
Do you help cast it?
No. I mean, Kathy was in touch with me about the casting process, but ultimately I think that's the director's decision.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I've got there's a fantastic cast. I mean, the leads are Sophie Hambleton, who's brilliant, playing Nora, and Arthur Meek, who's a wonderful actor, also a great playwright, is playing her husband, Theo.
So Torvald, I always imagined Torvald as being quite elderly, not middle-aged anyway.
Yeah, he acts middle-aged in the original one. I think what's interesting about them, you know, you have to find, to understand why they're together, they have to have a certain heat. Like, they have got a real chemistry. You know, they really are in love, in a way. Mm-hmm. And they certainly have got what other people would look at and think is a wonderful marriage. Oh, you know, that gorgeous young couple from down the road. But as Nora discovers through the play, it's working she feels that they're working as a team, but ultimately he's not doing the same deal that she is. That's what she discovers.
And we always think, I mean, in Ibsen's time, we think, oh, they were so keen on appearances and what people thought.
Mm. But look at us now with
social media. Right.
I mean, my God. And it's, you know, I follow all these sort of accounts on Instagram of people who are living hashtag blessed lives, and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
The sort of effort to look as though even our mess and chaos is somehow artfully arranged.
Yeah. It's really interesting, isn't it? That came as a sort of a shocking revelation to me when I realised that, because I thought that the whole, you know, appearance, doing things for the status and the show of it was a really yesterday thing.
It's worse now than it ever has been. I think there's enormous pressure. Yeah.
Mm. Are you writing another novel as we speak?
Oh, well, not as we speak. That wasn't what I was writing minutes ago. Yes, I am.
Oh, look, it's a shopping list. Oh.
I do like, there was a cartoon in The New Yorker from years ago where two people are talking to each other at a party and one's saying, I'm not writing a novel either. And I feel a bit like that at the moment, to be perfectly honest.
Are you halfway through one?
I'm halfway and a bit through. And, It's interesting. It's a constant process of trying to keep the faith. And again, that question of what to chuck out and what to keep is something that I'm grappling with, shall we say.
You always have.
Yeah.
But I mean, in this particularly so?
I think it's partly just because of time pressure. I haven't got a very clear run at it, and so I'm trying to make decisions about it in sort of snatches.
It would be tedious to ask you what it's about, I suppose.
Well, if I feel like if I talk about it, I probably jinx it.
All right.
No,
I completely understand.
Sorry.
That. No, I can't even ever begin to understand how authors would give me an answer other than that, as it were. Mm. But it's always worth a try, don't you think? The Fuse Box, then, the book we mentioned earlier, Essays on Writing from Victoria University's International Institute of Modern Letters. You and Chris Price have edited it. Elizabeth Knox, I come to this because there's a story in the news at the moment about how almost 400,000 New Zealand adults did not even start reading a book last year. Did you see that story?
No, I didn't, thank God. That's fascinating.
Now, this study hasn't been done before, so there's no comparative figures. But even so, when we go, we love reading in New Zealand, you think that's extraordinary. Mm.
You know, it's funny, I was thinking about this, obviously, around something like the publication of the Fuse Box, which is a book for people who love reading, who want to write, who might not have written before, and also for people like me who are writers and have been writing for a while, but, you know, need some help and some guidance and refreshment along the way. Yeah, I think when you hear a figure like that, it's really easy to think, oh, my God, is novel writing like Morris dancing?
And Elizabeth Knox says.
You know, is it just going to become some arcane little activity?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, she doesn't quite go that far, but she does. I mean, she's staunch defence of fiction, particularly. Yes. I mean, these 400,000 New Zealanders, no book at all, fiction, non-fiction, whatever. Yeah. But she says reading fiction is health-giving. It makes you calm and orderly. A person with, I don't know about that, but fluent feelings. So, she says, I believe in books and reading, but because I'm a pessimist, I don't believe enough other people do or can be made to. And then you have, you know, the almost 400,000 New Zealanders didn't read a book last year. Mm. She might be right. Are you pessimistic?
Weirdly, no. I mean, despite that, you know, whether that's magical thinking or not, I think what I'm not pessimistic about is the importance and the centrality of language in people's lives. And whether that's through storytelling in fiction or through telling non-fiction in an illuminating way or poetry or drama, it's just so central to being human. It's so central to how we think, what we do, how we communicate. And in my job, you know, I'm very lucky because I'm working with people who want to write and are writing all the time. But that's what I see. It's just like a human urge. So whether or not it ends up looking like a published book or a published collection of poetry or a film that gets made or whatever, that's not necessarily going to be the end point of every piece of writing. And in fact, there's an amazing sort of practice of teaching creative writing in prisons that a collective of writers called the Write Where You Are Collective is doing. And
I've interviewed writers
for this book. Yeah. And, you know, that really turns on its head the idea that, oh, we will write to be published and to be read by other people. It's not, nor is it saying it's as simple as, oh, these people are, you know, they're taking writing into prisons and it's got a therapeutic function, although possibly has. That's not really their drive. It's simply a way of thinking about the world, of feeling the world, of engaging with it, that I think we're always going to need, no matter what happens with the book industry.
One of those writers, Pip Adams, she says she'd always, this is in the interview that you have in the Fuse Box with her and her colleagues, she says she's always been dubious about the therapeutic potential of art, but there is evidence-based research, she says, that through imagining yourself into someone else's experience, you can build empathy, which, of course, is important if you're talking to people in prison one way or another.
Yeah, and you can self-reflect too. I mean, I think we often find out what we think by writing about it. Like, you think through that process of writing down. Mm. And of course, the beauty of writing is that it's not a live action. You can revise it and go back. Refine yourself. Is it Janet Malcolm who says that her books are smarter than she is?
Oh, I don't know. I think it was Margaret Atwood who said she doesn't know what she thinks until she writes it down.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
She writes in order to find out what she thinks, or with that effect. Mm. Mm. We were talking about social media before and how maybe that's made us so much more aware of our appearances. Maybe that's taken us away from reading. Certainly, it's an example of self-absorption, is it not? Which is the opposite to what you and Elizabeth Knox are saying we get out of reading.
Ah, that's an interesting thought. I suppose, I don't know, I don't engage with a huge amount of social media. I used to really like Twitter because it doesn't feel like you're being self-absorbed when you're on Twitter. It feels like you're having a conversation with people. But there's a certain amount of performance that goes along with it,
obviously. I think that's what I mean.
Yeah. And I think that's right. There are so many ways in which we are, yeah, I suppose through social media and other things, maybe framing and presenting ourselves. And, yes, better perhaps to spend some time going away and being quiet and having something come in through the form of reading, but also practicing writing in a different way that's not necessarily about presenting it or presenting yourself through any great lens to the world. You know, we had a recent visit from the Australian writer Charlotte Wood, who talked very brilliantly to students about why she's been writing.
I didn't get to talk to her because she'd lost her voice. How come she talked?
I'm so sorry about that, because it was before she lost her voice.
Oh.
I know. And then she...
Anyway, we're talking to her next month for people who are desperate.
Great.
She's great, isn't she?
She's so brilliant. I know. But then I think her voice just completely failed on her. Luckily, she said some great things to the students before that. But she talked about how her reasons for writing have changed, and actually how initially she was very funny about the fact that she almost wanted to be liked through her writing.
Right.
You know, and how that's just a bit of a trap in a way. You can't go on like that. You can't write in order to be liked. You're going to end up with a problem like Nora in The Doll's House, who's basically living her life in order to be liked.
That's right.
Yeah.
In your essay in The Fuse Box on silence in writing, you agree with Sarah Maitland, author of A Book of Silence, when she says writing isn't compatible with silence. You say writing is oral.
I guess I mean, I think
oral.
I think you hear it when you write. So I feel like when you're writing something down, you're also in some low-level way hearing the words in your kind of mind's ear. And so it's not a totally silent
practice. Is that because you've got a lot of characters in
Well,
your
it's
head.
Partly them. You know, your characters feel like they're populating the world, which is really... can feel quite companionable. But it's also just the sounds of language itself, I think. You know, writing is, it's something that we absorb sometimes silently, but also there's a whole lot of writing that we're meant to experience through hearing it. And yeah, I guess that's just, to me, that's an important component of writing. So don't feel like that image that we might have of the solo writer in a sort of monk-like way, sitting down, scratching out their, you know, their words in silence, is not my experience of how it feels on the inside.
Is that a particularly New Zealand thing? You know, it's a very collegial kind of society we have here.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting... I haven't thought about that. I mean, I suppose I see in the creative writing classroom how that collegiality actually works.
Yeah.
I mean, people are sort of hothousing one another's work in the sense that there's all, you've got access to a whole lot of different kinds of responses and ideas. And so work can progress at much faster and richer rate than it might do if the person was, making all their discoveries alone. But those solo discoveries are really important. I mean, I don't think you can... You have to balance it. You have to be prepared to take yourself away and be solitary as well.
I wanted to ask you, just going back to The Doll's House for a moment, we have to stretch our imaginations to think about how sensationally shocking it was at the time.
Mm, mm.
And I'm wondering if you struggled to find something that was as sensationally shocking as that now.
Well, this is the curious thing, and it will be for audiences to feel that or not feel it, but I still find it really shocking, the ending of the play. I find it was hard to write, it was hard to revise. I had to really try and, you know, hold my nerve and not pull my punches on it, not try to offer a slightly... happier or more hopeful ending. It depends on who you think it's hopeful for. In some ways, I think the ending is really hopeful for Nora. It's certainly, I want it to feel like a necessary ending. But, you know, I was talking to Kathy McRae, the director, about this, and she finds it hard too. So I think it might not have... I think what might be shocking about it is that we're still capable of being shocked by a mother leaving her children.
Yeah, interesting. Very nice to talk to you. Thank you. Emily Perkins, who has adapted Ibsen's A Doll's House, shortly to be put on at Circa Theatre in Wellington, and also edited, along with Chris Price, a new book called The Fuse Box, Essays on Writing from Victoria University's International Institute of Modern Letters.